thought I'd like to read some poems that I hadn't read for a while, and maybe an oldie or two, as long as my voice holds, and it's going pretty fast. So if you have trouble hearing me, I hope somebody will raise their hand so I'll know to try to raise the volume a little bit. Is it all right so far for overs? Okay. A lot of these poems are pastoral poems, and they take place or take their origin from Nebraska. And there's nothing very pretty about Nebraska particularly, but that's just where I happen to be. Thanks to the bell, by the way. That's where I happened to be for a while, and I got all infused with some kind of Midwest pastoralism. So it has the Nebraska stamp. But it might just as well be Iowa or Illinois, where I was born on a farm, or Minnesota or wherever. Wherever Interstate 80 runs close to. I don't know if you're close to I-80. Well, any interstate will do, doesn't it? They're all the same. They've all got neat truck stops and rest stops and little cafes and things like that. But I really have grown fond of. I think it's from when I was a kid. We used to go to southern Illinois back to the farm all the time. And we'd be going down 66. And we'd stop. My dad was one of those fanatics who, once he got behind the wheel, he never wanted to stop till we got there. Because he knew we could save X number of dollars in hotels if we didn't stop. So usually he drove straight through. And so I kind of got used to going in these little beaneries and seeing a sign that says Jesus Saves, written on a silo with a tired waitress inside, maybe at 3 in the morning, and a couple of truckers in there, and maybe a little sign that said zoo, and there wasn't any zoo, it was a sleepy coyote and a couple of rattlesnakes, and another sign that said last chance for gas, no gas for 1,000 miles, and a Whiting gas, there's always Whiting gas. And of course, just over the rise was Albuquerque with 1,000 gas stations. But my dad always said, where are we going to stop? And I said, can I go to the bathroom? No, you can't go to the bathroom another time. Just fill that up and go. And many times I'd wake up in the back seat, scrunched between servicemen, because this was in the 40s. And my dad was always picking up servicemen hitchhiking during the war. And the servicemen would be passing a bottle of beer or a flask of whiskey back and forth between them and reliving the good old days and singing ribald and bawdy songs. And I'd wake up in the morning and I'd have, what's it called, you know, the ruptured duck on the pin to me. They'd be giving me some kind of medals and they'd be gone. And I wouldn't ever be sure they were there. And yet I knew they were because my dad was driving all night and he picked up the servicemen. I could count on that. And we never questioned that. It was just something, a ritual. There they were in Albuquerque, and they were going to St. Joe, or Danville, or Decatur, Greenville, East Alton, Edwardsville, Carbondale, great spots. And we picked them all up. So the interstate that I want to talk about could be Interstate 80 or it could be 66 or whatever interstate you happen to be on, because you know they're all the same. Some states have better rest stops than others, I must admit. In Nebraska, they're a little bit far apart. You can go from You could go from Sydney to Lincoln in one swell swoop if you're not careful. You should get off at Seward. The Seward-Milford off-ramp is where I want to start tonight's reading. And that's about 25 miles from Lincoln. And you'll miss it if you're not watching for it. Nobody watches for it, which is why the town has managed to save 5,000 people, in addition to a great little college, Concordia Teachers College, with a great president, Ted Genzo, who is remaining against tremendous odds, a tremendous force for good in Missouri Synod, in my opinion. And I'd like to dedicate tonight's reading to Seminex and Elim and all that that stands for. I-80 runs along the Blue River, and the hot station wagons boil over beneath the diseased elms that bear the red X. Next year, we're promised pin oaks, croons the elderly lady, passing out brochures. The river is green from the trees, green and thick, slow moving between the muddy banks. The plaque reads, prehistoric Indian site. God, all they got in Nebraska is dead Indians, says a man in shorts with black dress shoes and long black socks. Skeeters slap whack with a brochure on rednecks. Hell, let them keep the place. And off on I-80, heading east to education or west to retirement, leaving the blue sluggish in its banks and the Oto bones quiet beneath the green hillock. And that sign is there, the prehistoric Indian site. The Oto bones are really there. When I published this poem, they said the editor fouled it up, and I forgot what he put, Otto bones or something. He didn't. It was awful. But I too late to catch it. Otto bones. There's a little town near Seward. Well, there's lots of little towns. There's only little towns near Seward, come to think of it. There's nothing near Seward of any size except Lincoln, and as I said, that's 25 miles away. But when you're in Nebraska, that 25 miles is like 25,000 miles. And in the winter, it doesn't exist. Lincoln is not there. And then you just kind of wait till the first thaw, and you can plan your first trip into Lincoln to go to Sears and Roebuck and buy popcorn and stand on the corner and kind of rock back in your heels and say, how do to all the folks. I mean, those are great times. You don't knock those things, right? You know how it is. And all, of course, all the farmers in Seward will come out every Saturday night and stand and munch their popcorn on the square across from the statue dedicated to the fallen soldier of Seward. And they rock, they stick their hands way down in their bib overalls, and they rock back and forth. You just kind of get in the rhythm there. If you kind of talk to them, you kind of get in with them. But the little town called Temora, which is about 12 miles from Seward, doesn't have a post office, and it doesn't have... Well, it doesn't have anything really, but it has a tavern. And the tavern was interesting because inside was an old gal, very fat old gal, three teeth missing like the wife of Bath. And she was a jolly old soul. She sold beer by the case if you were on the faculty. And you could sign your name and get a discount. And so once a month or whenever, we'd hop in the car and we'd go out there and we'd bring back the case of beer to Seward. And I never got to know this old gal. In fact, the people in my poems I didn't get to know except through the poems. Sometimes that's the only way you can get to know people, is through what you write and what they write. And I think there's probably worse ways to get to know people than what they write and what they say. Christmas in Temora. While children chant St. Luke in unison, and the masked choirs of Seward handle Bach with polished emotion, in Temora, a fat old woman sells beer by the case. Her bed is by the door, and the bar is long and smooth. In the winter, you must drive 12 miles through the snow and ice, and you must sign the faculty sheet for discount. Temora has 35 people. That 12 miles is a tight line stretching between sleeping and waking. Even the faculty sheet cannot contain the price of Temora, nor the parables of Jesus know her name. And St. John's of Seward sleeps beneath the snow, and the Milo is banked with snow, while wolves wait in ravines, snuffling among the frozen roots. And one man sits at the bar, and they drink away the cold and his memories of Oklahoma. By the way, I usually try to tell folks at a reading, if you want to talk, ask me something. If you want to clap, clap. If you want to sit there and just think about it, that's okay. Be easy. Do what you want to do. If you have questions, let me know. A dear friend of mine died December 10th, 1972. We'd known each other for 12 years, and that's not a terribly long time for a friendship, but I don't know whether friendships need a terribly long time. Ours didn't. His name was Mark Van Doren, and in my opinion, one of the greatest American thinkers and writers. And I have a poem entitled Autumn Amber for Mark Van Doren. Only those hours, those sweet, sweet hours that float amber on the late day's sun. Only those hours bring the smell of coal dust black on the Midwest air. Just at autumn, the wind amid flowers sets that darkling sky adrift. Clouds run through golden streamers, flecking rust on leaves that wander everywhere. Just there, in that autumn amber, in the rows of smoke and leaves, in just that time, I remember amber dreams a poet weaves. This is a good time to put in a plug, too, for the paperback of Van Doren's poems, which I have in the bookstore. It's got a picture on the front, a very fine collection. 100 poems, it's called, paperback. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1940, and I don't want to talk about it. Yes, I do. He's just a great writer, so you've got to be sure and read his stuff. I wrote several poems about his farm in Cornwall Hollow, Connecticut, and this is a sonnet which comes from that set of Van Doren poems. It's a sonnet with winter coming on. Those rolling, rolling clouds of dark and light that spread themselves across the autumn night, those chilling winds that cut the tops of trees, blowing leaves and faces as they please, and coating winter water mirror bright with frosted crust that's only slightly glazed by orange, reds, and blues and drifting leaves, runs heavy crested on the hill and grieves like eyes that stare open wide and dazed. These clouds and winds I see in winter dreams. They race and sing, then leaping up so high, a pale white moon is struck, or so it seems, and silver stars are scattered in the sky. During this year in Nebraska, we met all kinds of interesting folk, and some of them we didn't meet. But I have already explained that. I think it was Jerry Evinrude who kept ribbing me about not being able to find Nebraska. I said it took him, 3 hours on dirt roads, and he never could get there, and it gave me a bad time. And, of course, I'm not surprised that Jerry couldn't find it, and told him so. But he did stop in. He did finally find Seward and headed for the college and ignored everything but the music department, which is right, because Seward has a tremendous music building. And while he was there, he said, asked some prop or other, or somebody said, didn't Ledbetter here? And the person thought that, and I taught there, by the way, 1964 to 66. And the person stopped a minute and said, well, yes, I think I did see him here. I believe he's here, yes. And so you see, in Seward, it's kind of like Brigadoon. 10 years didn't mean anything, really. He said, I think he's probably still around. Probably in the English department. I think he's fine with it. And that's good. I think that's kind of neat. Next door to our house was some people, more people we didn't meet. Of course, in Southern California, that's not a rarity where I live. But in Seward, Nebraska, it was kind of a rarity not to know the people across the street. But in this house, I never saw them. Oh, I saw them maybe on the swing. On a side view, where I saw the windows part, the curtains part, to look out. But as far as I knew, they were just neighbors. Just neighbors? They had grown flowers this year behind the house and planted things that looked like radishes near the old incinerator. A squirrel comes to nibble corn they throw up on the frozen ground, and as the skies turn gray and blacker than any night, they peek between the curtains to see if someone is coming up their walk. Their walk is clean. They sweep it every day in case of visitors, but none have come their way for years. The mailman hardly stops except for bills or ads addressed to occupants. But always they sit and rock and watch the leaves blow down from their pin oaks. I see them crowd together in the fall with the one blanket for them both, and still they rock in the old porch swing until the weather drives them inside behind the door, where they rock and wait unseen. That was December. They haven't come out for the little mail that spills over onto the frozen porch. Their curtains haven't moved when we pull into our driveway, and my wife tells me to go and see, except that I'm afraid to find them waiting in some dreamlike sleep that won't awaken for me. And then the company will come for them, in uniforms officially gray and circumspect, and everything will be discreetly managed in one small mention in the Advocate Wednesday next. The paper boy forgot to take them off his roof, and today threw a paper on the thawing ground and rang the bell. But no one came. But I confess, I watched their curtains to see if they would come and show two long faces looking past the trellis vines to see if someone was coming up their red brick walk. Well, I-80, we did get off of I-80 once in a while. Not a whole bunch. One time we got lost in Wyoming somewhere, and we were looking for a place to camp, throwing sleeping bags right out on the ground. Maybe some of you have been lost in the same place, God forbid, but it's called a Wind River Indian Reservation. Does that ring any bells?
Yeah.
All right. We pulled in there, and a place, I put the bag, the tarp down, and I watched the 18 million ants converge on that, and then wasps came. And then some little kid came up the street carrying a dead rattlesnake. So that's it. Everybody into the 65 Ford wagon. And that was a heck of a night. It was 85 degrees. And I let the dogs, we always travel with two or three dogs, and I figured they'd be safe. So they slept outside and we slept in the wagon. Right down the road from this really raunchy place, which turned out to be, as most things do, really a great place. Seemed nothing like hindsight. Right down the street was a very clean camp with concrete slabs and a little post office thing and a little bar and a sign that read zoo, and I didn't want to go near that. And guys with wingtips and long black socks and their cameras hung around their necks and suntan lotion and hats full of 18,000 flies and no place to fish. They're bawling the kids out and the kids are throwing rocks at the coyote in the zoo. So I said, no, not here. So we drove 30 miles into the Indian Reservation and slept there. But the poem came, Wind River Indian Reservation. This is where we didn't stay. The sign read zoo, and the foxes and coyotes leaned against the screen and winked at the Wyoming sun. They took no notice of the Bermudas, long black socks, New York shoes, and the burned up children that threw rocks when parents looked away. Their trailer was carpeted, air-conditioned, white starch sheets, and a Sony TV brightened with Johnny Carson as the camp fell asleep, and the seven Indians talked in low voices inside the Wind River Bar. Once in Seward, though, it was all right. It was a good year and good years since. The poem came from that experience here in St. John's, which is a huge church. And I called it Better Than Gospel because there were times when it was very difficult to keep my mind on the actual gospel. So we liked to sit in this one place where I did because the sun came through and did things on the glass they had in the windows, little bits of chipped glass. I knew if I sat there at 11 o'clock service, I could at least see that. The pale sun filtered through the oddly shaped pieces of colored glass and striped the pew in front of me. I was glad for the diversion as the gospel was yet a long way off and the epistle was being sung by the choir, who had been coached by Mrs. Kleist in the proper way of choiring epistles. The minister looked dubious and belched into his hymn book. The acolyte stood when he should have sat, and the congregation, ever on the alert for new dimensions in worship, rose. And then the minister had to rise. And the choir director, seeing the minister, thinking that some kind of heavenly cue, cut the choir off short. And I, after all, had my spectral sunbeam oozing its way across the lovely pleats of the girl in front in a perfect hush, with everybody standing and waiting for the choir, or the minister, or the acolyte, and I smile at that, thinking it's better than gospel. Read a poem now that I wasn't going to read. I know that probably sounds phony for a poet to say that, but six people have asked me to read it, and there's no way that you can avoid it. Not that I want to avoid it anyway. It's called Bright Spot Cafe. By the subtitle of Cottage Cheese, which it doesn't exist. Everybody keeps saying, "What's that about Cottage Cheese?" Okay, and for those of you who have not heard it, I'll just set the scene very briefly and then get into the poem, because I'm liable to get lost on another interstate and forget what I was going to read. But it takes place in northern Iowa on the way from Forest City to St. Olaf to Minneapolis. And I was lost in all three spots, and hungry and tired, and I saw a little sign from Bright Spot Cafe. It's still there, and I pulled off the road, and this is it. The sign read, "Eat." In a soft April rain, I pulled across the gravel White Rock Road. "Use other door." There wasn't but one door. Inside, the old-timers laughed and pointed at my fumbling. Inside, into a quiet table and the waitress. "Bring me a cheeseburger and coffee." "Want the cottage cheese?" "No, just cheeseburger and coffee." "Don't you want the cottage cheese?" "No, just, how about them french fries?" She stood a while as I studied the tablecloth and then sidled over to the window and gave my order. "And you don't want the cottage cheese?" Such a hush then. The ramrod-backed farmers turned on their stools to gape my way. I flushed hot and studied the mysteries of my menu that showed the map of Iowa, saying, "You are here, Dubuque is." And finally, to look up at the eating faces all engrossed in their cottage cheese. The man across the aisle shoveling it in while his mother gave him what for with each mouthful. "I say no mutton chops. Mustache okay, but them chops point your nose, Roger." And the words trailing off to a table next to mine. "Dewey's is the best. There's a new man there who lays them out so natural you wouldn't believe it. And he's reasonable. $74, get your casket, wreath of forget-me-nots, and add the advocate. And the new man lays them out so natural." Finally, my cheeseburger. Small, rounded, cheese unmelted. I look in vain for onion, pickle, lettuce. And the hovering waitress, noticing my hesitation. "Now you want your cottage cheese?" Silence. Silence again in the Bright Spot Cafe as chrome stools turn, farmers look, and conversations hang suspended in beatific silence. "Yes," I say, and Iowa resumes its humanistic center of the universe as heresies and dreams alike are laid to rest, looking very natural. My throat is on the way. Dale, you may have to read these. I'd like to read, just change the pace a little bit, and read a poem entitled, "How Do I See You, Lady?" How do I see you, lady? In all your restless hours, you pass so many eyes greedy to seek you out. Where is the time, lady? Where can land enough be found to take you to and have you stay? Give me some sign, lady, if all I leave unsaid is water on dry rocks, or do you hear as well as I the sounds of laughter in green places? Lift up your eyes, lady, see reflections of your own and mine, and cross this space that levels out and offers comfort if we dare. Speak in silence, lady, and I promise to be brief and true. Thank you. Thank you. Don't forget, I said you could ask questions, and that kind of helps me get an angle on where you are and where I am. So, if you want to, pardon? If you have any questions, speak up. No, all right. Plum Creek in blue, in the Blue River, Little Blue, intersect in Seward, Nebraska. And when I got there, it suddenly unlocked all the memories I'd stored up from Southern Illinois and Greenville. And the Little Blue and Plum Creek became Mill Creek, where I used to swim naked when I was a kid, got ear infections and always got spanked. And then Bill and my cousin, and we'd go out and swim the hog waller on the farm, and we'd get spankings for that. And we'd pretend we were cows and lick the salt. And he got a lot of spankings. And got ear infections, yeah. But I loved Mill Creek, and I loved Plum Creek, and the Little Blue. And this poem is about some of those memories stored up from those little creeks. My grandmother took me there when I was 9 to fish for bullheads. We lazied on the slippery mud banks and let the line harden in the heat. At night, my grandmother read from the New Testament while I caught fireflies. I can still see the gaping mouths of the fish as they flopped in the shallows on grandfather's stringer. And while grandfather tended the small fire, I watched the moon sink lower and lower into the creek until the catfish, my grandmother, and the moon were one, filling the woods with light. And I slept, listening to the slap of water down the creek where fish jumped in dark pools.
Jack?
Yes.
You talk often about Bill. Have you written anything particularly
about Bill?
Him?
No, I haven't. I've got to do that. Bill's in the story I told the other day, last week, and before I read a poem called Waiting for Christmas about Claus, that thing. And Bill is very much in the story. He's not in the, well, he's in the poem, yeah, in a sense. Yeah. Bill and I were brothers. I have a half-brother that I didn't know very well, but Bill was my brother. We did everything together. Got in trouble constantly together. Stuff like that, but I haven't got a poem about him. He's too close yet. He had the meanest temper of any person I ever saw in my life. When we were little, he used to like to step on my hand and pull my fingers up. Fine fellow. and he cussed. He's a deacon in the Baptist church now. Got a great pot belly. And sings those good Baptist hymns, but boy, what a temper. But he's good people. Good old Bill. There's the park in Seward's called Seward Park. Yeah, it's not the Piazza's anything or other, it's Seward Park. And this poem is entitled Independence Day, Seward Park, 1973. The creek rose and flooded the park. The calf bellowed from the swollen river, its front feet raised on logs and branches that swung against the pylons of the bridge. No one asked how the calf got there. No one seemed to care about its history or probable lack of one. But over and over, the muzzle blew waterspouts and bleated in short trumpet snorts of sound that carried the people at their barbecue farther down the park. The rain that was supposed to hold off began to fall in soft scattered drops, which drove the couple playing softball beneath the public privy roof, and children left the calf to run the cars which gunned around the white rock road and out, while the calf bleated like a sheep, lost its grip on the logs, and slid slowly like some ocean-going steamer, all bubbles and spray, and disappeared beneath the bridge. The Wednesday paper called it unfortunate and said Mervyn Zillig owned it. So many of these poems, it seems to me, are sad poems. And sometimes they start out as if they're not going to be sad, but they kind of are. Because there's a tremendous sadness in southeastern Nebraska, in the Bohemian Alps, in that area where I live. The people are sad people. They're full of life and they're full of joy, but sadness at the same time. You know what I mean? We'd be driving Route 34 on the way to Lincoln, on the way to the university where I was going to school and teaching. And we always passed this one barn where the old man was out there feeding the cows, and his wife had the old hat pulled down and the boots up to here. And we always see those people, and they always stare at us as we drove by, every twice a day for a year. And then in the summers, same people. And I always wondered, who are they? And a couple of times I almost pulled in, but you know, you don't. You just wish you had, right? Like the day Robert Frost died, and I picked up the phone when I was teaching at Lutheran High in Los Angeles and started to call the hospital, and somebody said, don't do that. They won't let you talk to him. And I hung up the phone, and I wish I hadn't. Well, one day, when we first arrived in Nebraska, plugged in the TV for the kids, and the funereal-looking face came on and said, Blaze Akula died on his tractor. And that's all he said. And that's all I got. And every time I passed that barn, I thought, are you Blaze Akula? Isn't that a beautiful name? Blaze Akula. Great Bohemian name. Blaze Akula died on his tractor. Not under it or because of it. He died on his tractor. The evening news sandwiched it in between the Funk's high-bred commercial and the weather report from Hastings, Grand Island, New York. It was very hot the day Blaze Akula died. All the fans were whirring in the Seward County Courthouse, dragging their great black-bladed fans across the sweat-darkened tops of rooms, where men sat with eye shades and sleeve holders, reckoning time by holes punched and dogs licensed. His wife of 57 years gathered eggs from the barn and plucked the big Rhode Island Red off her nest. When he didn't return for lemonade and fish at noon, she went to the cool, dark cellar for jars. She saw the county pickup bounce through the gate and raise the dust against the white house. She watched the men from the screen window of the root cellar, the cold jars and brown eggs in her basket. Well, I didn't meet Mrs. Kula either. But somehow, you don't have to shake hands with them. You didn't have to pull into the driveway. There they were. And there they remain. Right here. And here. And now you know. Pardon? No, I don't mind. Blaze Akula died on the strap here. Not under it or because of it, he died on his tractor. The evening news sandwiched it in between the Funk's hybrid commercial and the weather report from Hastings, Grand Island, New York. It was a very hot day, the day Blaze Akula died. All the fans were whirring in the Seward County Courthouse, dragging their great black-bladed fans across the sweat-darkened tops of rooms, where men sat with eye shades and sleeve holders, reckoning time by holes punched and dogs licensed. His wife of 57 years gathered eggs from the barn and clucked the big Rhode Island Red off her nest. When he didn't return for lemonade and fish at noon, she went to the cool dark cellar for jars. She saw the county pickup bounce through the gate and raise the dust against the whitewashed house. She watched the men from the screen window of the root cellar, the cold jars and brown eggs in her basket. Well, I'm going to get off Seward for a minute. The month I've been up here, I've got several people who have come up with poems and lines and haiku and short stories and one thing and another, and it's really been, for me, some great things. It's amazing where that muse moves. I have one little poem by a little 7-year-old girl. I know she's, I don't suppose she's here. Is Dan here? I wouldn't think she would be.
No, she's not here.
Oh, but are you, you belong to Ann?
Yeah.
Oh, then I'm going to read it since you're here. She came up and stuck this in my hand. On one side is a little girl jumping rope, on the other side is this little poem called Poem. I wonder what it would be like to have a friend to go wherever I went all the time. And I have another poem that, by Maya. Maya, are you here? It's called, well, it doesn't have a title. But this is inspired, I'm sure, by one of her hikes around here. The mist has stopped, the sky is still. It leaves a shimmer on the hill. The green stands stiff, flowers cupped tight, waiting for a warming light. I stand observer, my garland gone, to see the mountains early dawn. Isn't that nice? Good things. I wish I had time to read some more things that people have given me, and to read, where's Beth? Is Beth here? To read your short story that won second prize in your literary magazine, which should have won first prize because I read both and yours is best. Not better, best. I know what I'm doing. Okay, do you have any thing you'd like me to read before I launch into a couple?
Yeah, can I ask you on your style of your poem, it's a form of prose as opposed to poetry, and many of us can learn the things under the spreading chestnut tree, or my children you shall hear, and come up with rhymes at the end. It's almost prose. You want to make them, and some of them had stories or second or third meanings to them. Do you want to make any comments on your style, or do you think your poems really have other meanings?
Well, I could say one thing which didn't make a whole lot of sense is what Tolkien said about Lord of the Rings. He said, this is no allegory. And everybody who reads Tolkien, you read them and you believe it, but you smile at yourself and say, oh, wait a minute. I don't mean anything but what the words say, and yet very often the writer is the last who knows exactly what he means. I've often said, and I don't want to get on a lecture, but I've often said that the writer is the only one who knows what he's doing. The paradox of that is the listener is the only person who really knows what he's doing. The person who hears the music or feels the sculpture or watches the dance or reads the poem, the art belongs to them, no more to the sculptor or the musician. And yet paradoxically, it does belong to them. It belongs to both. And then the art, the music, the poem has a life of its own somewhere between the writer and the listener. So there are three things going at once. Yeah, a lot of my Stuart things are a lot of free verse, so it does sound kind of prosy. But I can write tight things when the spirit's really there. When the juice is going. Can I read you one? All right, called The Woods. And it's iambic tetrameter. And, well, I won't go into that. But just listen. And when you listen to the words, listen to the trees in your mind. Those branches there, did they move? Stand close a while. Soon or late, it might be there again. I'll prove to you these woods can hear. Wait. There, it made the noise. I heard it move, some subtle shift of shade beneath the branch. You say a bird, I say something else. Some sound nature made for us just because she wanted to. You needn't look at me. If you want a name, bird will do. I know what I saw and see. My former advisor at the University of Nebraska made the appalling statement that nobody writes in rhyme or anymore, or meter. The minute he said that, I knew we were in for a rough haul on my dissertation. And we were, and we locked horns hard. I don't know who won. I got a new advisor. And especially when he made a fatal mistake of calling Mark Van Doren a second-rate poet in a third-rate city. I have to look out. But I think poets still use rhyme. There's a good, you know, squirm structure, there's a place for that, as well as free verse. Robert Frost said, writing poetry without rhyme is like playing tennis without a net. And he could do anything he wanted to with rhyme, like Shakespeare. It's easy. It's so difficult, it's like breathing. It's that difficult. It's light. The most serious things are light, as air and clean water. He could also write good blank verse, Death of a Hired Man. I'd like to read, coming back to free verse, which is what I work in naturally, I think, a poem about a home, called a home. And it's what happens after the auction has taken place and all the things have been auctioned off and everybody's gone and the old woman is left and she's got to go. The hot morning sun sucked the shadow off the wide board porch where the old woman rocked. The bustle in the house was noisier than necessary, but she rocked the same for all of the talk that hung heavy on the August air. From her porch, she could see the ladies gather across the gravel street, their heads bonneted and bent in the trellis shade. Her long, bony hands tightened on the smooth, brown rocker arm. She shuffled her feet on the porch and lifted a yellowed handkerchief to her throat, then let it drop in her lap. The sun spun in a mazy light, white motions in the beams that struck the hot roof of the pickup that bumped the ditch and rolled to a stop at the porch. The driver smiled a wide, clean smile and said, "Ma'am," as he leaped the steps and banged to the screen door. The old lady tried to say something as he jumped the steps, but he moved too fast in the sun. His face blurred in the web of years and held her in a chair. The ladies in the shade looked up as the family started out the door, formal like an odd parade. They marked the ties, the old blue suit, the fan, the brooch, and how they passed the chair but turned at awkward angles to look before they got in cars. The old woman rocked and rubbed one hand upon the other and felt she ought to tell them of her dresses that they folded in the truck. And the ladies on the swing cried, "Hush, and come out and see now," to others in the house across the street. The sun came up the steps. The chair rocked, but slower. And turning once, she saw the neighbor's cat lying quiet in the gladiola, watching the soft brown birds dancing in the bird bath. And she kept looking at the cat and the birds. As she lifted from her chair, her back held firm by long, strong arms, her head against his chest, the world moving around her as she watched, and all the world there was sat quiet across the street as the trellis vine stirred slightly in the darkness of the porch. Well, I have, I don't know, if I was put to the wall with a gun at my head saying, "Speak, is it religious or not?" I'd say, "No, not that one." But if it invokes a religious or a spiritual feeling in somebody, then it sure is. But I have all these poems that I wrote for the Lutheran Witness and some other religious magazines, which are explicitly or overtly religious. But if I had to say whether I thought there was such a thing as sacred and secular, I'd say no, I don't believe in it. I don't think there is such a distinction. Mm-hmm. It all comes from the same source.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That poem you just read before, isn't there another one that goes along with that about the auction?
Yes, there is. I didn't read that because I keep looking at my watch, but there is a right. Yeah.
Could you read that one? I don't know what it's called, but I remembered about something about Jesus when he was a baby, and it was... Okay.
Boy, are we on the right wavelength, huh? This poem comes from a picture of Madonna and Child with Chancellor Roland by Jan van Eyck. And I was trying to see into that. It shows Mary with little Jesus on her knees talking to the great man. One day the Christ child came, and the world blinked its collective eye at that. The babies come. The sounds of the marketplace rose in smelly mounds of buzz and talk, and the babies stared at the priest, as babies do. Some talk got out. A savior was come. The shaggy beards nodded in solemn tones, bespeaking years of dreaming. This baby, said they, and Jesus probably burped, as babies must. Thus the world saw God, a trifle chubby about the middle. He saw the world and smiled cooled eyes at man, knowing innocently the angel smiling back, and loved it all, oh, loved it all, as only this baby could. Let me read, get away from Seward for a while and read another religious poem based on the resurrection by Grunewald, which Dale showed the other day in the slides. Those of you who missed the slide, Christ is exploding from the tomb with the sun literally on his shoulders, looks like, just going up. Called, "For Thee He Rose." Beyond the special door that shocked the world with its secret when it exploded with a risen Christ, the pause, the listened for word that is simply and cleanly there, for the world and for you, for these, he rose. The room ceased its noise for an ice cube moment. The piano player laid large bony fingers on the black notes that held them still. The muffled sound of bright oranges rumbling down the big shining chute to the waiting trucks echoed among the groves. The overall tickers looked for the sound. They held their long cold knives poised, blinking against the bright smear of color of the green orange trees. From beachward at morning, the row on row of flowers sang in the salt breeze that floated upward to the grass chapel on the hill, offering a plastic view to those who leaned with knee or foot on the wall, their cameras poking to fix the scene for years. And below the bluffs, the bronze boys rocked on the groundswell that ran to the dark green kelp beds at shore. But they who sat below the 49th Street L stammered against the vision of words and stared blankly at the carbons and crumpled pages and wondered. And for these he rose. Swift and vigorous he rose. And the air still sings of it in all the reaches of the universe that men who breathe may know. It's there to see and feel and believe. For these he rose. Maybe I ought to just bring this to a close, and if there's any time for a couple of questions, I know there's a laying on of hands at 10 o'clock, and so let me read this. This is the latest poem, which I read a week ago when I was doing eye openers with Rich. It's called Life Elegies, and it's in four parts, and I tried to discuss the life of man in four stages. What comes after the first spin of star comes quickly. Whatever music plays through the rising sun and through the gossamer moon is learned. And if there are worlds yet to come, to be touched and drank with the same transfiguration already sensed by those fern-tipped atoms of the self, let them come and praise. Let me hear something now and praise, and cover my mouth with light that the iris may open to dreams coming, to songs singing, and sounds beating against the jasper stone, and praise. Then comes the bangled breath, heaving light, spiraling through all oceans of darkness, washing against the somber mountains of misery, and blasting tomorrow into today. Praise sound, winds howling tomorrow. Praise sight, foxfire, tail and eyes. Praise smell, close in between cantatas of bodies. Praise touch, that waits like new dawn for us to believe in. This time is like no other, oh praise. This time is forever coming and is here. This time will always be lost and regained a thousand days and nights unfolding in front of us. Waiting, praising, living, being today and young once only through milk-white waters, rushing beneath flying feet toward another miracle. Then the second part of the poem takes us a little bit, finds us a little bit farther down the road. Some of us in this room belong to part two. Everybody, and some have been to part two. And it celebrates right now. This day bleeds with hoping, yet soothes with being what it is, and with what I am, have become. There is no other time. The leaves falling today are beautiful beyond sense and power to claim them. They fall gracefully in arcs undreamed, and today is my only dream. This day gives comfort if only I listen and do not question where I go and what I do. There can be no further voyages or this one fails. I see no horizon because my body claims the skies and defies the past, and today is my only dream. This day quickens to song every strange beast and bird hiding in atoms everywhere. There were no sounds yesterday when snow tasted like silver, and tongues were deaf to tongues tasting desire. There are oceans of life. There seem to be poundings of wings. The blood fastens, nails reach, minds heave mountains, and everything today is now, is hot, cold, is spirit banded by muscle thrusting among rocks and roots, snuffling, cracking, knowing a day and a night when all things come clear and the pillow is wet beneath our mouths, and today is my only dream. And then part three finds us farther down the road. And we begin to see things and hear things and sense things differently than we did in part one or part two. When trees burn with cold deep in the forest, only the wind is there to know. Where whales sweep currents away from north to south in the cold season, the great sea mountains exult. While grasses move beneath some pale sky, sliding and barely breathing goes as rustling. And each thing has its time, each monster of love its business, each man his age. Cries sound vaguely like calves penned for the night against the wolves in the ravine, or sheep on the hillside bleeding against the slanting sky. There are sounds of age within the very rocks and deep inside the bones of the sea. And smooth pieces of wood wash the shores as hands feel among old leaves for echoes. Hats lie dusty, propped on shelves. Watches tick something away like magnets teasing the planets from the sky. And all is spent. All is running down like waters on windows after the storm has found new balance. And nights are longer with sleep-awakened dreams of a sun-washed land where once they owned the right to tomorrow, where now they own nothing but this dark crack of night, this nesting place, this warm thing that holds them earth close with a patience cracking crickling, which bends to hear whatever sound and dream whatever dream to come. And finally, the last part. Night sounds are heavy sounds, like a heart under cotton. I hear signs are in the sky. What do they say, these signs? They say, walk here today between 3 and 5 o'clock and watch for the postman. They say, remember, bones break easier, as if bones know anything. These signs say, half there. They scream beatitudes from open land with little flags, wilted flowers, and rectangular histories that leave no room to walk in this park. Such signs are heavy. Give me light signs. I'm not dead yet. Show me colors, all right? Dark colors, big brown. A potato is brown and cunning after all the simple things are said about it. Black doesn't scare me. The edge of today is black. But signs don't explain the bones. Colors are not real. The ground draws me closer. It wants me to relax. And I lie down with a kind of smile and think of each step, each mile, every sunset and sweet kiss I fail to measure yet cannot forget. These are my sounds. and sign. This ground that pulls me away from myself is my night. This grass that pricks my eye, and I reach my trembling tongue to taste it, and all the world fills my mouth.